I am speaking with State Representative Margaret O'Brien, here to talk about what the legislature has been doing and what they are going to be doing in the year ahead. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Let's start with this last session. There was a very busy lame duck session. What do you think was accomplished here, and why do you think it is important for moving Michigan forward?
Well, first, let's talk about the lame duck process. It's referred to lame duck because there's a number of legislators. In this case in Lansing, there was a number of state representatives who were either term limited or were not reelected or chose not to run again, who would no longer be in session in January. And one of the common questions I've had is, why was this lame duck so much busier? And in fact, when you look at the last 10 years, this is only the third busiest lame duck over the last, 10 cycles. The two previous terms, both the 94th and 95th legislatures, had more actual bills that were ran through the House than in the 96th legislature. So my point there is, it was a normal lame duck process when you look at the past. And over the lame duck process, we had a number of bills that ran through. I was very fortunate to have some of my own legislation that went through. And it's just an interesting time, because if we don't act, both the House and the Senate, on the legislation that's out there, it all essentially dies and must be reborn, reintroduced in the next legislative session. And so we dealt with a number of issues. Probably the most popular that everyone knows about was right to work. But there was a number of really important legislation that went through. One was about 7 or 8 bills that dealt solely with the city of Detroit. The Detroit City Council and the Detroit mayor requested that certain reforms happen. It was very important for the future and the revitalization of Detroit. That was passed during the last 2 days. I was able to have some legislation that dealt with inventory taxes on new construction that went through. Senator Shoemaker had a couple of bills that went through that dealt with juvenile competency, meaning setting a standard to say if a juvenile is competent and can stand trial for crimes, and if they're found to not be competent, to allow for interventions for troubled youth. One of the frustrating things the courts and the mental health system has had is sometimes juveniles will commit crimes that aren't enough to get them not enough to get them convicted or to go through the process, but everybody knows there's problems. And Senator Shoemaker's bill allows for the early intervention. So we had a number of important pieces of legislation that went through lame duck, but since it's such a short time frame, a lot of it was missed by the general public, but a lot of good policy work was driven.
Let me ask you about a couple of process things. Did you suppose that people may be a little disturbed by a lame duck session, because when you combine people who were defeated running for re-election, those who perhaps had another term that they could have run for but chose not to, those who were term limited, and then those who won re-election but they're in their last term beginning now in January, you have a lot of people who, at least in theory, will never be facing the voters again, at least for the office that they currently hold. Do you think the public is somewhat bothered by that on the House side, that when you come back in the lame duck, there's a lot of people who can cast a vote and then don't have to face the voters again?
There's always going to be some who are going to be opposed to a lame duck session, and it's usually those who disagree with the reforms or the legislation that's passed through. I have heard a lot of compliments on how productive and effective the lame duck session was. They were very pleased with a lot of the legislation that went through. I had about 6 bills that went through lame duck. All of them had been introduced in 2011. They had been vetted, but at one point or another, they tended to be so technical in nature that they're never going to make the front page of the newspaper. And so when a front page issue was introduced in Lansing, my issue kept getting bumped to the side. So I had 6 different pieces of legislation that went through lame duck, and they were all good pieces of legislation. They just weren't anything that was really controversial. And so they kept getting bumped. So the lame duck session was very important for crucial legislation to get passed. Now, it is important to note, neither the governor nor the Senate was in lame duck. So if the governor or the Senate felt it was bad policy, they could have easily stood down anything that the House did. I will say that my colleagues, both in support and opposition of bills who were not coming back, they fought their conscience and their fights. They did not just skip out of session. Probably the bigger issue you would have is somebody who's not coming back. Why do they need to cast a hard vote? But they stayed there until the long hours of the morning, and they cast their votes.
The other thing I want to ask you about is putting right to work and the new emergency manager law into appropriation bills, which shields them from referendum. Is that a dangerous precedent that might be eating away at our rights as citizens to ask for repeal of a law or a referendum on a law?
You know, it would only be a dangerous precedent if it was something that truly had never been done before. It's very common when you're dealing with key policy issues to put an actual appropriation in there, especially when you know it's going to cost money. And one of the things that we had decided when the Republicans took control of the House, a criticism that Michigan citizens had had is you pass legislation, you know it's going to cost money, and you don't appropriate the money to implement it. And so we have tried to be very cautious, and by and large, very few pieces of legislation have had an appropriation in it. We've tried to work with the governor or work with it in the budget in advance to make sure it was there. But when issues have come up that we had not put into the budget, we have made sure the appropriation was there. Here with the issue of right to work, the governor has already posted for a person to be hired to be helping with compliance, to be dealing with confusion, because there is a lot of questions about when it takes effect. It had immediate effect, so most people think, well, April 1st, I have a choice. No, you've got to read the law. And so there's a lot of education, both with those who are in unions, those who are in the management of unions, those who have unionized forces within their companies. It's very important that they follow the laws and they don't violate them, because April 1st does not all of a sudden give that employee in a union the choice of whether to be in or out. There's a lot of technical details. So there was a real appropriation made, and the money is going to be spent. And so in that case, it was very appropriate. Now, if an appropriation had been made of which you couldn't speak to where we're going to actually spend the money, then I would say it's politicking. But when we have policy issues that come to us with an appropriation, I make sure I'm asking the questions. How is it going to be spent? How did you derive the figure? What is it? And if it's just a token dollar amount and there's nothing to back it up, it can be challenged in court. Now, if those want to deal with right to work and be able to challenge it on the ballot, they do have the way they can do it and deal with it with the Constitution.
But I'm wondering if future legislatures are going to look at it that way, or will they look back and say, here was this bill, it generated some controversy, the way to avoid having a direct referendum on it was make sure that there's an appropriation in there.
Future legislatures will always look back at previous legislatures, and we did that when the Republicans came to control the House and said, how do we want to manage and lead the House to ensure that people can debate and be able to speak on the House floor? And it has been done in the past. Sometimes it's been very questionable. We tried to ensure that if we were going to pass legislation with an appropriation in it, it was needed. And if my memory serves me correctly, I want to say it's only three pieces of legislation that we have passed in 2 years that had an appropriations tied in. Everything else, we worked with the governor's office to make sure that he had the ability to move the money around in his budget. And in these three pieces of legislation, either there was no budget yet done, or it was something totally new, like right to work, and the money was not currently there.
What would you like to hear when Governor Snyder delivers his State of the State address tomorrow night?
Well, first, I'd like the governor to lay out the map from where we started from, what we've accomplished, what have been some of the issues that have popped up along the way that we have not anticipated. And then I want him to lay out the roadmap for the future. And not just the future for the next 2 years, but the future 10, 20 years from now. We all have a shared vision of a successful Michigan. Obviously, there's going to be different strategies different people want to employ to get to that end goal. But to talk about where are we going incrementally, step by step, it's my understanding he's going to be talking about roads and infrastructure. It's really important, and I hope that he's going to dive into the topic that as we move to more fuel-efficient vehicles and we move to more hybrid vehicles, how are we going to deal with roads? Right now, all the solutions put out there are still based on gasoline and taxation of some sort, whether it's increasing the taxes at the pump or it's talking about changing it to a wholesaler tax instead of paying for it when you fill up by gallon.
And the reason you bring up hybrid and fuel-efficient vehicles is because if vehicles are using less gasoline, then you're not collecting as much in tax revenue from that, from a gas tax, as you would otherwise.
Exactly. We have two issues. As we move to more fuel-efficient vehicles, if we have a system that is heavily reliant on gasoline taxes, it is going to be a system that will continue to decline. And so that is a failed system from the get-go. If we look at gasoline taxes and hybrid vehicles, as we get better with technology and the vehicle prices come down so that the average family can afford it, then those users do not currently pay into the roads at all. And so we then have people being taken off the system. And there's a third component we also need to consider, which is any form of infrastructure funding in which a user does not contribute to the funds. And we need to make sure that if we're using transportation funds for trailways or anything of the sort, how are we making sure that whether it's a local match or it's some user fee, to make sure people are paying into the system, we have to make sure we're not building a system that 15 years from now doesn't have the people to pay in to maintain it. It's very important. And then finally, it's looking at efficiencies. What efficiencies need to be maintained? Currently, some of the road money goes to pave parking lots in the parks, the state park system. To me, that shouldn't be a road issue. That should be within the park budget issue. We need to make sure things are more transparent and they line up correctly so that when people are paying at the pump or they're paying at the plug-in, wherever they're paying, they're confident the money's going to the roads. And I hope there's going to be some form of local partnership. And when I talk about local partnership in the city of Portage, I pay up to 3 mils of property taxes for roads. And the roads in Portage are traditionally known for being very good and for being very well maintained. I do not want Portage to be penalized for their residents spending their money on roads and thus resulting in less of a state allocation to them if we are able to raise more money. So with the roads, I hope he takes a comprehensive view. And I know he's not going to be able to dive into details, but I'm going to be looking for the key words about the future, 20 years down the road, about what is the issue about the roads. 20 years from now, I don't think we're going to be driving cars with the same efficiency of gasoline, and we're going to have more hybrid vehicles on the street. So we need to be talking about whatever his proposal is now. Does he think it's going to last for the next 20 years? And making sure that he's looking at it very long range, not just how can we get our roads up to speed in the next 2 to 3 years. I think he's also going to be looking at education. He has talked about educational achievement authorities. That legislation was introduced in both the House and the Senate after the election. It was in November. Neither the House or the Senate actually voted it out of committee and onto the full floor for a vote. There were some concerns with educational achievement authorities. I expect the conversation will continue. And this will be interesting to see if he uses the state of the state as an opportunity to address school allocation allotments. He's been talking about changing the per pupil formula. I know there's draft legislation that's been put out by attorney Richard McClellan, and it'll be interesting to see if he takes the state of the state as an opportunity to talk about what he envisions as far as how he wants to fund K-12 education.
I want to go back to roads for a moment, because the governor last year proposed an increase in vehicle registration fees. That did not get very much support anywhere in the legislature, including amongst the governor's fellow Republicans. Those are the users, at least of roads, right? What's wrong with the idea of vehicle registration fees or increasing them as a way to help fund road improvements?
I think it's fair to look at vehicle registration fees as, is that a long-term proposal that is something sustainable? And the main criticism I heard about vehicle registration fees were about for limited income families. It's very expensive to have to pay that bill. And if you have multiple cars, it can be very costly. And sometimes it also depends on the time of year in which you renew. All our vehicles are tied to my husband's birthday, which is in December. So we get nailed at the,
for all,
you know,
of them once.
Yeah, all the vehicles in December at the time when you're saving money for the taxes that may be owed the next year and trying to buy the Christmas presents. And so there was a lot of concern about hitting people with a huge increase right at that one time of year. The other concern was that it's tied to the value of the vehicle. And the value of the vehicle doesn't equate to the actual road usage or the wear and tear on the vehicle. So some of those complaints were given. And in addition, I think it would have been different if he would have said, let's just look at vehicle registration fees. But it was also coupled with gasoline tax increases. And my reservation about his entire policy was it might work for the next 3 to 5 years. But as we continue to strive for more fuel efficiency and we bring more hybrid vehicles onto the roads, I can guarantee that in 10, 15 years, we would be back at square one. I didn't want to support a proposal that I felt would break before we even got to 20 years. You know, in our world, things move so fast. We can only expect a structure to last maybe 20 to 30 years. Some are able to last longer, but I didn't want to support a proposal that I felt couldn't even last the 15 to 20 year mark.
When you brought up that point about value of the vehicle as compared to what it does to the roads, in other words, a hybrid vehicle costs more than a standard gasoline alone vehicle. And yet it would seem that most of those cars are smaller. The Prius and those sort of things are smaller cars. The Volt's a smaller car. Those cars are not causing the wear and tear on the roads that a bigger one is, right? Is that part of what you're getting at there, that maybe that needs to be part of the equation? What is your car doing to the road when it travels on it?
Well, you know, and that is part of the equation, and that's where if we look just at gasoline vehicles, there tends to be an equality. I have a Suburban. I don't drive it that often, but my Suburban does have more wear and tear on the roads than my Grand Am. And so, but my Suburban, because it gets fewer miles per gallon, it does pay more for the travel that we do. And so when we go on vacations, I know we're paying into the system to fund the roads. Now, with the hybrid vehicles, the hybrid vehicle probably has the same wear and tear as my Grand Am, even though it's smaller, because of the battery packs. It's actually a very heavy vehicle for its size. But they're taxed at a much higher rate on the registration fees. And we need to look at it. We're never going to find true equity, meaning it's going to be perfect for everyone. But we need to find a system that we go, overall, it's very fair. There's very few winners or losers, as they say. It's very fair as far as the inputs. And I would prefer a multiple pronged approach where we really encourage the locals to support the roads. I love my road millage in Portage because I know the money never leaves Portage. It doesn't go to the state, who then takes their cut of the pie to manage it and then sends it back smaller. The purse that's collected by the city, it stays with the city. And I know that if I have a concern about a road, I can go directly to my city manager, my city council, and say, can you help us? And they have the money and they have the ability to move some things around to deal with roads. When we send a large amount of money to the state, and if that money is intended for local roads, there's not the leverage or the ability to be as flexible. During my time on the city council, we always had a 10-year capital improvement plan, and every year we updated it. Inevitably, there would be roads that we had projected out that we said, you know, we thought we were going to rebuild in 3 years. They need them now. There's other roads we had scheduled for this year, but they actually have been maintained very well. We're going to swap those, and those will be done 3 years out. We have the ability locally to do that. The more and more we rely on state and federal funding for local roads, and when I mean local, I'm not talking about I-94 or 131, but local roads, when we rely on the state and the federal government, it means every dollar we send, we'll never get a dollar back. Because they're going to take their cut for management. Money's going to go elsewhere. We know Michigan's a donor state to the U.S. as far as roads. We don't get back a dollar for the dollar we send. And so I hope that he has some ideas to approach about what can locals do to generate the money locally, because that's going to be the most productive use of our taxpayer money, is if it never leaves our jurisdiction.
On another topic, Governor Snyder exercised what's called the pocket veto on a handful of bills at the end of session, including one you sponsored that would have expedited the process for removing the property of a deceased tenant from rental property. But those of us who are not in the property management business, how big a problem is that?
You know, this is a very isolated issue, but when it occurs, it's a big issue for somebody who rents out property. If you have a situation where It's traditionally going to be somebody who doesn't have large assets, maybe even not close family ties, but they pass away. And to dispose of those assets, the family needs to take control. And if there's substantial assets, you really need to open up an estate, you need to go through probate court. Well, currently, according to law, if a tenant passes away, the landlord has no ability to remove the items, even if they call the family members and say, hey, this person passed away. Can you get their items? The family can choose to say, we're not interested. We don't want anything. It's your problem. So then the landlord, to take back control of the property, they must actually open up an estate, which means they have to pay all the fees. So while it's not a regular occurrence, when it does happen, it's very problematic. And so what we're trying to do, and the governor's office has been more than good at working with me. We had hoped to be able to obviously avoid a veto, but that wasn't possible. And so we're meeting actually later this week to discuss this issue.
The governor's office, as I understand it, their concern is over allowing sufficient time, right?
Exactly. They want more time. And so the issues they've raised up are all very technical in nature, and they were very forthright and apologized to me. My bill had moved in the House much sooner, had not been controversial, all supported by Republicans and Democrats. When it got to the Senate, same thing. It was not controversial. The governor's office, unfortunately, had missed the progression. You know, there's, think of every bill I have to keep track of. Well, so does the governor, but I get to say no a lot more than the governor does because he tries to avoid a veto. So he often, his staff engages very early on and tries to find a way, can we make this bill into something the governor would say yes? And unfortunately, when it got to them, they realized they had missed their timing. And so his only choice was a pocket veto. So I'm expecting to reintroduce that after I've spoken with the governor's office. We're going to rewrite all the language, make sure it's signed off by him and the attorneys in his office so that it's something that he can sign. Again, it's a very isolated problem, but for somebody who rents out property, when it does happen, it can be very expensive. And often there are no assets to even disperse. It's all formality.
Is part of the concern about time that we might be dealing, say, with people whose heirs are out of state and perhaps, you know, the time in the lag that they have in getting time off from work and getting up to Michigan and those sort of things to take care of it could be substantial in some cases.
Well, the governor hasn't gone down into specific details. He said he wants more time to pass before the landlord can take control of the property. And so they haven't given me where in the process they want the more time. And that's where it's my understanding. We're going to be meeting later this week to discuss all the details. And it's all very technical. They agree with the overall direction, but there's a lot of technicalities that need to be done. But, you know, hey, I'm one of, I think, 5 or 6 people who got a veto.
And a pocket veto is even more rare, right?
Exactly. So. A pocket veto is very rare, and not every freshman legislator can say they had a veto in their first term.
Okay. Finally, to wrap it up, the last week when there was the formal election of Jace Bulger to be Speaker of the House again, there was a lot of talk about bipartisanship, trying to put the past behind and some of those things. You dealt with some pretty controversial issues in the last 2 years and also in lame duck. Do you see a new day moving forward? Is there the opportunity for some greater collaboration from both sides of the aisle?
I really hope that there's going to be bipartisan collaboration. There was a lot of bipartisan collaboration this last 2 years. A lot of people often phrase things in a way that makes it, I guess, a great political soundbite. It's when you're in the minority, it's not a great political soundbite to say the majority is treating us well. But there was a number of pieces of legislation that was bipartisan, that was supported by both parties. I had prison ID reform legislation that passed. It was a package of 4 bills. I was the 5th legislator from our community to introduce it, and it was been over a 10-year battle. I want to say it was almost unanimous support. There might have been 1 or 2 people in the House who had voted no. It was a big bipartisan outreach, tenure reform. I sat down with Democrats. I had a bill that had been originally sponsored by the former House education chair, which was a Democrat. And I sat down with Democrats and worked on that for 6 months. So there was a lot of good bipartisan support. Going forward, I know I have legislation that I've been working with Democrats and Republicans on. One reform that did not get passed was physical therapy direct access. That's my number one issue coming into the next year.
Explain what that is.
Well, it's been a 20-year battle. Currently in Michigan, you cannot see a physical therapist without a prescription. So you can see a chiropractor, you can go see a surgeon. Now, there may be certain processes to have your insurance company pay for it, but it's illegal to receive services from a physical therapist without a prescription of a doctor. Times have changed in our community, and I think it's appropriate to allow for direct access to physical therapists. And so that's an issue that the governor's office is very supportive of. I would be the first to jump up and give him a standing ovation if he mentions it tomorrow night at the State of the State. But I've been working with some in the Senate. I have been, over the last 2 years, I've worked with Democrats and Republicans. It's been co-sponsored by both. I'll be again seeking co-sponsorship. And in fact, the Democrat minority leader, he was not in the House yet when I had sponsored it, but he had told me he was extremely supportive. He was on the committee it was in front of, and that he would be looking forward to voting for it. So we're going to be tackling issues like that. There will always be issues that tend to be more ideological. That is why people pick parties. And those are always going to be great political sound bites. But the facts are the vast majority of the legislation that we passed over the last 2 years were Republican and Democrat supported. And often in cases like teacher tenure, where there was an element of controversy, I spent months sitting down with my partners on the other side to say, how can we make this bill better? What are your ideas and what are your thoughts? And I never asked in return that they vote for it. There were people who gave me ideas and I accepted every single one, and they still voted against it because they felt it voted their district. And there were others who said, I gave you my ideas, you implemented, I'm giving you my vote. But I was very firm on always getting their input. So I'll be continuing to seek input on physical therapy direct access. I hope to tackle assessing and be seeking input from both Democrats and Republicans to make the assessing of our homes and our properties more transparent, more simple, so that it's more user-friendly for the citizen, but also doesn't put the assessor in quite the bind that it currently does.
Okay. Anything else we should know before we wrap it up?
Well, I encourage people to watch the State of the State. It will be available online. If people can't watch the State of the State, there tends to be resources and documents put out by the governor's office. And you can feel free to contact my office if you have questions on the State of the State or any other policy issue. My toll-free number is 877-347-8061.
Representative Margaret O'Brien, thank you for your time.
Thank you.